AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Hijinks and Hearsay is a book that comes from Martin Keller, Greg Helgeson, Sinister Stories from Minnesota's Pop Life. And Martin Keller is kind enough to join us today to talk about that book. Hi, Martin.
How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing very well, sir. I like this book. This is a book. Greg Helgeson, my God, did he take a lot of great photos over the years.
Yeah, Greg and I worked together for, 15 years or so on various assignments, and he's been pretty protective of his archives until we sat down a couple years ago and said, let's create a book that isn't the same old oral history or feedback from reporting that we did. Let's tell the backstories to some of these great artists that we interviewed, great comedians, writers, and other cultural figures from this landscape.
When you sat down and started going through these photos, I mean, you knew obviously he had a lot of great photos. Were you kind of put back and like being reminded? It's like, oh my God, yeah, you have these guys and photos of these people. I mean, really a lot of great musicians, comedians, writers, as you said, many of them very early in their careers or in the height of their careers on some of these in some occasions.
Yeah, Greg and I looked at quite a few of his photos, and frankly, Greg's got photos that he doesn't know he has. he just has like an endless vault of material at his house, and he was one of the early photographers to shoot prints. Who else can I mention? I mean, everybody in the book looks like youngsters. Some of them are. I think Prince was 17 or 18 when Greg shot those photos at the Capri Theater. Prince's coming out party for his Warner Brothers debut. And, there was more than enough to choose from. And the way the book's set up, there's 42 little, I don't like to call them chapters, I like to call them vignettes of people that we interviewed and talked to, followed by, I think, three different galleries of Greg's photos, including blues and jazz artists, for lack of a better term, geezer rockers like the guys from the Byrds, Captain Beefheart, Richard Thompson from England, and then there's one more gallery in there, kind of mixed folks. So there's a lot of visual relief in the book.
And one of the things, and you kind of mentioned it yourself, one of the things I really like about this book is, there's been a lot of retrospectives on Prince in the last few years, understandably. And you talk about Prince here, but this goes beyond just one character or one time frame of, these 5 years. It talks about a lot of different people, a lot of different avenues, and it kind of gives a person a better understanding of what makes Minnesota pop culture and what, it's not, there is a lot of people, national artists and stuff that come through that that great photos of. But as well, it really touches on, kind of what made Minnesota unique.
Well, when we looked back, we started on this in, I think, mid-2016, and the book came out earlier this spring, 2019. Took us about a year to get a proposal together just because we have real jobs in our regular lives. But it's about a 9-month writing process. But when we looked back, we really realized that this period that we worked in was one of a kind. It was the rise of the Prince, the Paisley Park Kingdom, as we called it, the rise of the indie punk and new wave scene with Husker Du, The Replacements, Suicide Commandos, Suburbs. I mean, that's a long list. It was also the rise simultaneously back in that period of comedy clubs in the city. I think at one point there were five or more. And, that scene produced A-list comics like Louis Anderson, Joel Hodgson, who went on to create Mystery Science Theater 3000, Liz Winstead, who co-created The Daily Show some years later. So that was an important part, and we also realized that it was really the last analog era before the digital tsunami hit everybody in the 90s. And it was also, from a journalistic standpoint, it was the last, I think, true era of the alternative newspaper world that was really fostered in the 50s and 60s.
You mentioned Joel Hodgson and Jerry Seinfeld. You actually have a segment on them. I've talked to numerous members of the MST3K cast over the years. Trace is a regular on the show. I talked to Jay Elvis, Bill Corbett, Mary Jo. And I believe it was Jay Elvis said that Joel Hodgson, he felt, was the ultimate Minnesota comedian. That, you know, you just at the end of the day, that guy understood this town better and he could convey it through his jokes better than anyone else. The segment he had with Seinfeld, I mean, Seinfeld on his Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee actually has a segment with Joel Hodgson. I don't think a lot of people would realize that those two guys were friends.
Those guys have been friends from a very early point in both of their careers, and they both kind of took off on different comedic career trajectories. I happen to know both of them before they, you know, Jerry got pretty big fairly fast in the 80s once his TV show got on the air, and Joel's was a little slower. It was more of a cult following with Mystery Science, but man, what what an inspired concept, you know, talk over bad movies. I mean, I still hear that at the cinema these days. the photo that Greg took for that is really a pretty sweet photograph of Jerry and Joel, almost dressed alike, leather jackets, blue jeans, tennis shoes, outside of a parking lot in downtown Minneapolis. But I think, you know, Joel did represent the Minnesota sensibility a lot in his comedy prior to doing Mystery Science. And I have to add that he had an incredible look he would give people. He was so understated. He could just raise an eyebrow and get a 20-second prolonged laugh.
I'm speaking of comedians, I also am very glad you included Liz Winstead here. I think that she is to a point overlooked dramatically, but I think her importance, especially into our modern culture, one of the more popular shows still on cable television is The Daily Show, what she started. She, you know, she really did, I don't want to say, you know, news or political comedy per se, but I mean urgency comedy. I mean, she understood the ability to take something that existed for many years, which was these parody news shows, and she turned it into something far better than it ever, I think, people ever imagined it could be.
Well, she said in an email to me when I was fleshing out some details about her career, she made the comment, and this is in the book, that comedians are the only ones that are really allowed to tell the truth in society, even though it's done for laughs. But I think that's pretty much true, and Liz has always had a political sensibility. I think it was more finely tuned once she went to New York and started dealing with real-world issues on a daily basis for The Daily Show. And she's since gone on to be a very passionate advocate for women's reproductive and health rights, which is an admirable position on her part, and she's doing very good work along with her colleagues in that camp.
You know, you look at the when you talk about the ripples, you throw a rock in the water and the ripples and the rings that form. You know, Colbert today, who came off Daily Show, I mean, everyone is trying to copy his shtick right now, which once again, you know, that influence, that impact, that person that comes up with the idea. Or Joel Hodgson, we can talk about him as well. My God, I mean, ever since Mystery Science Theater 3000 really garnered traction, I mean, I always said that the character of like Chandler on Friends was just a guy from MST3K that they, you know, ran out there with the best lines. I mean, the impact on comedy, and we can also throw Louis Anderson in there as well, the impact on comedy that came out of this town is spectacular, and I think you guys capture it very well.
Yeah, and it's funny because comedy scenes were blooming all over the country in certain metropolitan areas. Chicago, of course, was Second City, and Seattle, I think, had five or six comedy clubs during the 80s. Los Angeles, of course, and New York, Boston. Those are really the comedy centers, but Minneapolis had had a lot going on here, and as you said, they, a lot of the comics influenced the next generation of comedians and also writers. A lot of writers from that period who were doing stand-up went to Hollywood and silently became writers on very popular shows.
I'm going to the music world here. I mean, I've always loved Candy Apple Gray. Husker Du, they are still to this day, I think, almost, I mean, their impact is known. But the Replacements and in Prince, they're the ones that kind of get a lot of more flash on this. I think part of it is the fact that outside of Bob Mould, the rest of them have kind of, you know, they moved on. They stopped and, you know, one guy was a chef for a while and, you know, they did their own thing. But you guys capture them in here, and I think that, you know, that when I think about the 80s and I think about music in this town, I think about how the music seemed to conquest every different genre. You had Prince in R&B and pop, and you also had the Replacement in rock, and punk music would not, I mean, even today, would not be the music that it is without Husker Du, and I think that making sure that they're included in this book is a smart play.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The Huskers really contributed to what was called originally hardcore punk, but I think they quickly outgrew that, much to their to their benefit. They became much more expansive in their the choice of genres that they chose to write songs in, and they were pretty much a big influence on a lot of bands around the country. And that particular vignette in the book recalls a time when Zen Arcade came out, and I did a really self-confession time here. I did a really terrible job of reviewing that record, and I think Bob Mould picked up on it because he had copied one line from it and pasted it up around town at all the different record stores like Orfolk in South Minneapolis and Northern Lights in St. Paul, and it was a direct quote from a review of that record, which mostly has 5 stars in anything you read today about it, and I simply said it was transitional at best, and kind of an embarrassing moment, but that happens sometimes when you have a ton of records to listen to all the time and make some hopefully informed decisions about them.
One of the things I do enjoy as well about a book like this is discovering stories I had no idea about. I grew up in the 80s in Minneapolis. U2, of course, was a huge band, especially in that alternative music scene that I was kind of enjoying quite a bit. But I had no idea that they actually credit a good chunk of the songs for October to have been written during a sound check over at what's now First Avenue.
That's right. Greg and I had interviewed them at the Normandy, and, you know, those guys weren't more than 17 or 18. I think in the book I said they looked like hobbits that had strayed too far from the Shire. They all fit on a queen-size bed. I mean, they were petite Irish boys, really, and then we hung out with them while they did their sound check. And, you know, the sound check went on for quite a long time, and I heard a lot of good riffing and stuff, and later discovered that a lot of bands actually do write songs during sound check if they have the time. And that's exactly right. A good chunk of that October album was created on stage during that sound check.
I also would be remiss if I did not bring up the fact that a guy that runs a radio show on this station, Paul Metza, he shows up in this book. You talk a little bit about the West Bank folk scene, which was a pretty strong folk music scene, and that was, you know, kind of I don't want to say a reimagining, but a revivalist of the Dylan kind of mentality of folk that really, you know, caught on for a while on the West Bank.
Well, you know, when Dylan came down here to go to college at the university, he was a rock and roll guy. He was a garage band kid up in Hibbing, and the people he fell in with around the U, they were all folkies. So I think that was a revelation for him. You know, the stuff that Spider John Kerner, Tony Glover, and Dave Ray were doing, I think that was highly influential on Bob's folk music development. There's, you know, many other names I could throw in there. But, yeah, the West Bank was a true pillar of the music scene here, and who knows how many singer-songwriters it's inspired over the years. But that period over on the West Bank along not just the folkies, but also the R&B scene with Lamont Cranston, Doug Maynard, Explodo Boys, et cetera, Willie and the Bees. I mean, that was another kind of pillar before the whole punk new wave thing blew up downtown at the Longhorn, and Bonnie Raitt pretty much adopted that scene on the West Bank. And there's some great stories of traveling with Bonnie in the book, Bonnie and the Cranston Band, for a week-long tour in the Rockies. It's got a lot of funny bits in it, and it's one of my more favorite chapters in Hijinks and Hearsay.
You know, one of the things, too, is that you just brought up, which I think is important, is we talk about kind of the golden age of Minneapolis music in the 80s, but the reality is all the elements were really there and were, you know, just kind of simmering at the time, because it was, you know, as you talk about it, you had the folk music, R&B was coming in, you know, rock was there. It was almost like Minneapolis needed to be recognized on the map. And, you know, studio executives had to get in here for it to really explode. But the reality is that it was really cultivated and growing very quickly, 60s into the 70s.
I think that's right. You know, the 60s had its own sort of first golden era of the sounds of Minneapolis versus what everyone in the 80s called the Minneapolis sound, exemplified by Prince and the Flight Time and Alexander O'Neill, mm-hmm. and then subsequently Jam and Lewis and the little empire they carved out. So I think that's true. The scene really got national attention in the 80s, due in large part to Purple Rain. And I think once record labels recognized there was something happening here, it was kind of pretty much the floodgates opened. And I don't know that they've really closed. I mean, you can look around now here, and as we move into the second decade of the 2000s, you know, we still have a really active scene. I was just talking with Paul Metza the other day, and he believes, and I think this is exactly right, that Minneapolis-St. Paul is the music capital, live music capital of the country. Probably even over Austin, Texas, which is kind of drying up. And certainly in L.A., there's really no live music scene like the one that existed back there in the 80s and 90s. And New York is pretty flat. So there's a lot going on, and that speaks well to the people that support it.
When you look at the bands that are around, I mean, Lizzo is now the biggest. Lizzo, you have Policia, you have Gully Boys. I mean, there's just a lot of great music that's coming out of Minneapolis, and it's still kind of influenced by this. Hijinks and Hearsay, it's not just music. It's about the Minneapolis pop culture, a fantastic book. Martin Keller, Greg Helgeson. Martin, I really appreciate the time. Thank you very much. This is a great book. I highly recommend it.
Hey, Matt, thanks for having me on, and I know Greg and I will be listening as you play this out.
Thank you very much. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.